Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that had no business flying as well as it did. It was too big. It was too heavy. The men who first saw it standing on the ramp took one look at that barrel of a fuselage and started calling it the Jug, short for Juggernaut, though some of them swore it was because the thing looked like a milk jug with wings. Fighter pilots wanted something lean, something that darted. What Republic Aviation handed them was 7 tons of iron with a propeller the size of a windmill, and it became one of the greatest fighters of the Second World War. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar, where we don't chase the pretty airplanes, we chase the ones with a story, and the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt has a story soaked into every rivet. Before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the coffee on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, your first solo, your private pilot ticket. That instrument rating you sweated through an actual cloud. All the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and friend, so does every airplane I'm about to talk about. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. It's the late 1930s, the men designing fighters mostly believed the same thing. Keep it small, keep it light, wrap the smallest possible airframe around the biggest possible engine and pray it holds together. That's how you got the sleek little darts of the era, the ones with the pointed noses and the tight cockpits. Republic Aviation had a designer named Alexander Kartveli, a Georgian, not the state, the country, a man who came to America by way of Paris and brought with him a stubborn idea that would have gotten him laughed out of most drafting rooms. Kartveli started with the engine, not the airframe, the engine. He wanted the Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp, 18 cylinders in 2 rows, 2,000 horsepower when the war started, and more before it was over. But here's where it gets interesting. Kartveli didn't just want the engine, he wanted a turbo supercharger to feed it, so it could breathe up high where the bombers flew and the air got thin. And that turbocharger was the whole problem, and the whole genius. You couldn't just bolt it to the front. The turbocharger had to live way back in the belly of the airplane, behind the pilot, fed by ducting that ran the length of the fuselage. Exhaust gas ran back to spin the turbine. Compressed air ran forward to the engine. Those ducts were as big around as a stovepipe and they had to go somewhere. That's why the Thunderbolt has that deep, pot-bellied fuselage. That's the Jug. All that plumbing is what gave her the shape her pilots teased her about. But it worked. Up at 30,000 feet, where thinner airplanes gasped, the Thunderbolt was still making full power and pulling hard. Now let me tell you about the engine itself, because I want you to feel what it was like to stand next to one. You start a Double Wasp cold on a morning, and first you hear the electric inertia starter winding up, this rising whine like a siren spooling. Then the pilot engages it, and the whole airplane shudders. The first cylinders catch with a bark that punches you in the chest. Blue smoke, oil smoke, rolls out the exhaust and drifts across the ramp and gets in your nose and stays there all day. Then she settles into that deep, lumpy idle that only a big radial makes, that loping, uneven rumble where you can almost count the individual cylinders firing. 2,000 horses turning a propeller over 12 feet across, 4 blades on the later models, big paddle blades like canoe oars, clawing at the air. The men who flew her said you didn't so much fly the Thunderbolt as ride it. She was heavy on the controls. She didn't dance. A lighter fighter could outturn her all day long. But the Thunderbolt had 2 things nobody could take away from her. The first was the dive.
She weighed 7 tons, and 7 tons falling is a hard thing to argue with. When a Thunderbolt pilot pointed that big nose at the ground and firewalled it, the airplane would accelerate like a dropped anvil. She'd go screaming down through 500 miles an hour, brushing right up against the speed of sound into a place where the air itself got strange and the controls got heavy as wet cement. Enemy fighters that tried to follow her down sometimes couldn't pull out. The Thunderbolt could. She'd bottom out low, still doing hundreds of miles an hour, and come climbing back up on all that horsepower. If a Thunderbolt pilot got in trouble, he had an escape route no other fighter could match. Nose down. Go. Nobody's catching you. The second thing was that she could take a beating that would have killed any other airplane in the sky. Now here's where it gets interesting. And where I want to slow down. Because this is the part that made grown men love this airplane. That air-cooled radial engine up front had no radiator. No coolant lines. Think about what that means. A single rifle round through the cooling system of a liquid-cooled fighter, one little hole in a coolant line, and that engine would cook itself and quit inside of minutes. The pilot was going down, but a radial could lose an entire cylinder, get one blown clean off, and keep running, keep making power, keep flying a man home. and all that iron around the engine, all that structure Cardvelli built to hold his heavy airplane together. It turned out to be armor nobody planned on. Let me tell you about Robert Johnson. Bob Johnson was a young Thunderbolt pilot flying with the 56th Fighter Group over Europe in 1943. One morning he got bounced, got separated from his flight, got jumped and took a cannon and machine gun working over that, tore his airplane to pieces, his canopy was shattered, his instrument panel was blown apart, hydraulic fluid and oil were running into the cockpit and into his eyes. He was hit himself, bleeding, half blind, and the airplane was on fire for a while before it went out.
He thought he was done. He tried to bail out and the canopy was jammed. So he decided he'd just point her toward England and ride her as far as she'd take him. And here's the part I still can't quite get over. A German fighter found him limping home. A Focke-Wulf, one of the best fighters Germany built. The German pilot pulled up behind Johnson's shot-up Thunderbolt and opened fire. Machine guns and cannon from close range again and again. Johnson could do nothing but hunch down behind that big radial engine and take it, and the airplane would not die. The German shot until he ran out of ammunition. Ran completely dry. Then he pulled up alongside this close, looked over at the American he could not kill, shook his head, gave a little wave, and peeled off for home. Bob Johnson landed that Thunderbolt back in England. The ground crew counted the holes, more than they could easily count. 20mm cannon strikes, hundreds of bullet holes, the airframe just riddled from spinner to tail, and the man walked away. That's the Thunderbolt. That's why her pilots loved her the way you love something that saved your life. Bob Johnson went on to become one of the top American aces in Europe. So did his squadron mate Francis Gabreski. Gabby Gabreski, another Thunderbolt man from that same 56th Fighter Group. The 56th flew the jug when other groups were trading theirs away for the sleeker Mustang, and they kept flying it, and they racked up one of the finest records of any fighter group in the war. They trusted the airplane. The airplane earned it. Now let me tell you about the guns, because the Thunderbolt didn't just survive. She hit hard. 8 50 caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing. When a Thunderbolt pilot mashed that trigger, 8 heavy machine guns lit up at once, and you could feel the whole airplane slow down from the recoil. It threw a wall of lead. That much firepower didn't just damage a target, it sawed through it. And that brings me to the second life of this airplane, the one that maybe mattered even more than the dogfighting.
By the middle of the war, the Thunderbolt found her true calling down low ground attack. She'd come down out of that thin high air where she was born and go to work in the mud and the flak, hunting trains, trucks, tanks, bridges, anything that moved on the ground behind enemy lines. They'd hang bombs under her wings, they'd hang rockets, and she'd dive in with those 8 guns hammering and tear up a railway yard, then take the hits from the ground fire. All that light flak reaching up for her, and that tough radial and that heavy airframe would bring the pilot home again. She was the airplane you wanted when the mission was dangerous and dirty and low, because low is where airplanes get shot, and the Thunderbolt was the airplane that could get shot and keep flying. Let me paint you one more picture. The early Thunderbolts had what pilots called the razorback, a raised spine running from the canopy back to the tail. It looked mean, it looked purposeful, but it cost the pilot his rearward visibility. And in a fight, the thing that kills you is usually the thing behind you that you never saw. So later in the war, they cut that spine down and gave her a bubble canopy, a clear teardrop of plexiglass blown into a single smooth dome, and now the pilot could turn his head and see everything, the whole sky. Clear to the tail, that bubble-top Thunderbolt, the D model in its late versions, is the one most folks picture. Big paddle prop clawing the air, that clear bubble catching the sun, sitting up on those wide-set landing gear legs that Cardvelli had to design to fold in a clever way just to make room for those 8 guns. They built more than 15,000 of them, more than any other American fighter of the war, 15,000 jugs. And when the war ended, like so many of these magnificent machines, most of them went straight to the scrapper, melted down. A 7-ton fighter turned into pots and pans and window frames. The very toughness that couldn't be killed in combat couldn't save them from the smelter. That's why the ones that are left mean so much.
There are only a handful of Thunderbolts flying in the whole world today. When you stand next to one at a warbird show, the first thing that hits you is the size. The photographs lie to you. You picture a fighter, something you could look over the top of. Then you walk up to a real Thunderbolt and that engine cowling is up around your head, and that propeller reaches down toward the grass and up over your hat, and you finally understand what those pilots meant. This is not a small airplane. This is a fortress with a propeller. And then somebody fires it up, and that double wasp barks and smokes and settles into that deep loping idle, and every hair on your arm stands up, and you're standing there in a Wisconsin field in the summer sun listening to 1943 come back to life. If you ever get the chance to hear one run, don't walk past it. Stand there. Close your eyes.
That sound carried Bob Johnson home through a sky full of lead. That sound is worth stopping for. The stories today I owe to the men who flew her and wrote it down. Robert Johnson's own account of that day over France, the combat records of the 56th Fighter Group, and the good work of the folks at the National Air and Space Museum and the Warbird historians who keep Carvelli's story alive. You can find more of what we do over at RadioHanger.com. The jug was too big, too heavy, too ugly, some said, and she brought her boys home when the pretty airplanes couldn't. There's a lesson in that somewhere for all of us. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.